The word and texts. Hebrew Bible, Micah 6:6-8. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down for the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And the Gospel, Matthew 5:1-12. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." The contemporary reading, selected readings from The Immigrants by Tony Simpson. After the long voyage, the immigrants looked forward with longing to the sight of their new home. Alfred Barker wrote, "With very long faces, we saw what a fearfully rough country we had come to. And the gloom was not abated by the sight of three small vessels lying wrecked on the rocks. And, to my utter astonishment," William Bannister was to write of his arrival in 1840, "there is not a house or place to receive either cabin or steerage passengers, so that we were obliged to remain on the ship for 14 days, I mean, women and children. The men and all the boys that were able went on shore for the purpose of making houses for our future abode." Jane Bannerman wrote, "We had to take up our life, and very rough it was at first. Our boxes were piled up on each other, and it was 6 months before we could get them unpacked. There were no rooms in the house, and we had a fire outside to cook on. There was abundant food. How sweet we thought the potatoes, beef and mutton, are good, and plenty of fish and pork could be had from the Māori." And the response, "For the word in scripture, for the word among us, for the word within us, we give thanks."
We must begin our story by remembering the first minister and the congregation he led. It was the Church of Scotland that made the decision to send a minister to accompany the Scottish settlers aboard the Bengal Merchant. His role was to be both ship's chaplain and resident minister. The Reverend John McFarlane from the Martyrs Church in Paisley answers the church's call and was duly appointed. On the 30th of October, 1839, the Bengal merchant left Glasgow. It had been chartered by the New Zealand Company, and there were 89 adults and 33 children aboard. The departure of this ship was regarded as an historic occasion, and shortly before she left, the Lord Provost of Glasgow, along with a large party, went on board and addressed the passengers. John McFarlane began his onboard duties, and each Sunday during the voyage, the ship's crew and passengers assembled for worship. After the first service, he distributed copies of a pastoral message. When we look at the ship's list of occupations, we discover that all the steerage passengers were relatively humble people seeking new opportunities in a new land. There were farmers, farm servants, women servants, and tailors, and there are single entries for mason, wheelwright, shoemaker, candle maker, ploughman, gardener, sawyer, painter and glazier, baker, joiner and cabinet maker. John McFarlane was well aware that he would be encountering an Indigenous people who spoke their own language and who would have had relatively little contact with English-speaking people. One of his first priorities was going to be able to communicate. He was indeed fortunate to have a fellow scholar on board the Bengal merchant, a Mr. Johnston, a Wesleyan missionary from Edinburgh. As a basis for their study, they used extracts from a New Testament in Māori and the English liturgy, which had been translated by the Wesleyan mission. At the end of the 3.5 month voyage, John McFarlane had built up a working vocabulary of approximately 1,000 Māori words and phrases. The Bengal merchant's first port of call in New Zealand was at Port Hardy in Derwent Island. The ship's captain fired some cannon shots into the air to announce their arrival and to attract attention. In response to this noise, a canoe of Māori came alongside. As can be imagined, the most urgent need on board was for fresh food and water, and the Derwent Islanders were willing to trade. A shirt was exchanged for 4 baskets of potatoes, and a counterpane was exchanged for a pig. It is recorded that during this first contact with local Māori, John McFarlane put his newly acquired Māori language skills to good use in order to find out where the closest agent of the New Zealand Land Company was stationed. After a stop of 2 hours, the Bengal merchant set sail for Port Nicholson in Wellington Harbour, arriving on the 20th of February, 1840. Those on board were mightily relieved that they would shortly be on dry land, but having heard some distressing reports of attacks upon settlers, they were also somewhat apprehensive of what awaited them. Their fears proved to be unfounded, and very soon after arrival, John McFarlane was describing local Māori as having a most friendly manner. "I am going to leave John McFarlane on board the Bengal merchant, gazing at the Wellington coastline we all know so well, and perhaps already planning his first sermon in this new land."
Valerie has told us about John McFarlane, our First Minister, who 180 years ago was almost here in New Zealand. The journey was described as tedious and lasting 113 days. On February the 1st, 1840, the Bengal merchant had another 3 weeks of sailing to go, including the stop at Derwent Island on February the 10th that Valerie has told us about. We have a history to be proud of. I will say a little bit about that on February the 23rd, when I will imagine what John MacFarlane may have said to the congregation he brought out here, and he may have referred to the proud heritage and ancestors of the Tangata Whenua who welcomed them and cared for them. But since then, there have been 180 years of faithfulness, commitment, vision, and sheer hard work. I wondered what this parish was like over those years, so I found out some facts from the midpoint, 90 years after our foundation and 90 years ago in 1930, by referring to the parish communion roll for that year. One thing stood out from the communion roll was that in 1930, nearly all our members lived locally, or at least in Wellington City. Out of 369 on the roll, only six lived in the Hutt and Eastbourne. So St. Andrew's has changed from a church that people attended because they lived nearby to one that we deliberately choose, even though it means not going to the nearest church to where we live. Jack Somerville wrote in Jack in the Pulpit a reference to this, and he said, "So began a ministry which was the central point of my experience. St. Andrew's was a wonderful congregation in which to serve because it was completely in line with my experience and concerns for the Christian message in public life. It had been a parish mixed in social grouping, but a prime target for visiting and pastoral concern. Times have changed since then. North Wellington as a residential area has been torn to pieces by motorways and building programs, and the older St. Andrew's families have disappeared. But let's look at the enormous human time and effort that lies behind what we are doing today. Our first church building, the Scots Church, and then was opened, I think, in 1844, and the second church was on this site, or maybe it was a third church, I got a bit mixed up with that, in 1879. After that church burnt down in 1920, and this church was opened on February the 22nd, 1923, 83 years, less a day, since the arrival on Petone Beach. And since then, that wonderful Croft organ has been installed. Then recently, we have completely done up an earthquake, strengthened our church, and built all that we have out the back. Well, we started with 122 arriving on the Bengal Merchant, of which an unknown number actually became parishioners, but presumably a large proportion did. We had a communion roll of 369 halfway through our history in 1930, and now we have, I think, 166 on the parish roll that I have. From those figures, I think it is pretty sure that we have had over the years at church on a Sunday at least what we have now, which is about 70 people. So that means that 180 years... times 52 Sundays, times 70, is the number of times that the way of Jesus has been heard spoken about in this parish. That's over 655,000 times. Now, that just includes Sunday services. But add to that what has been done for children and in other events. Also, all those hours that people have given in committees and other ways they've served here over the years. On top of that, there is our outward-facing interactions with our community. This parish has stood out in our commitment to social justice. For example, the support for conscientious objectors, the support given to strikers in the 1951 industrial dispute,
the opposition to the 81 Springbok tour, the declaration of this church being a peace church, the submissions to Parliament contributing to the passing of the Civil Union Bill, the Marriage Equality Bill, our support for the Zero Carbon Act, to name just a few, our support for refugees with our involvement with changemakers. There is the contribution made to society through St. Andrew's Trust for the study of religion and our theologian in residence, Sir Lloyd Gearing. We are an inclusive parish, as illustrated by our support for the Rainbow Community. There is our support for the Living Wage Movement and our weekly support to the downtown community ministry with our food bank donations. We are a progressive church, and I believe we stand for an interpretation of the way of Jesus that is open to our different opinions, so it's not dogmatic, but makes sense in the light of today's knowledge. That is just a very general overview, and I'm bound to have left out many achievements that may have come to your minds. But I just want to make the point that what we do here is based on a great foundation. We are the present screenshot of a great story, and we should be in awe of that and aware of our responsibility to those who gave so much of themselves. Since I've been coming here, I have suspected that this parish has been growing. That is quite remarkable when compared to other more liberal parishes. I suggest that many of you come here because this parish is not afraid to get involved, is out there in the community standing up for what the way of Jesus really stands for, even if it means getting some opposition. We stand for something. We have a purpose in our world. John Macfarlane would surely have been looking to the future 180 years ago, a future faithful to their past. On February the 23rd, I'm going to air a dream that I have for a possible future mission for this parish. We'll now sing Give Thanks for Life. And once again, this is in honor of Shirley Murray. But we'll stand for this one.
Thank you. wonderful singing. We will now take up our